Ask any American to identify a civil rights leader from the 1960s, and you'll get a list of familiar names, from Martin Luther King Jr. to Malcolm X. Today's movement for Black lives and social justice, however, doesn't have leaders that are as visible or as iconic as in the past. And many young activists say that's just the way they want it. As protests around the country continue to gain momentum and force change, they're doing so without necessarily having visible figureheads. To understand the role of leadership in this powerful moment and how it compares with past and recent social movements, I spoke to George Ciccarello Marr, a visiting scholar at the Decolonizing Humanities Project at the College of William and Mary, and also Peniel Joseph, a professor of public affairs and history at the University of Texas at Austin, and the author of The Sword and the Shield, The Revolutionary Lives of Malcolm X and Martin Luther King Jr. Peniel broke down what leadership of Black Lives Matter looks like today.
Black Lives Matter wanted to be a movement that didn't have representative leaders, but they were a movement that was filled with leaders, especially Black queer feminist leaders. So what they eschewed, following the advice of Ella Baker, who had been the founder of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC, which led the student protest and sit-ins of the 1960s, was this idea that charismatic leadership was ineffective in the long run. So is the critique of Martin Luther King Jr. a critique of Malcolm X? It's a critique of this notion that you have this one very charismatic, usually Black male figure who is representative of the entire movement. And so when we think about Black Lives Matter, they've really cultivated and produced thousands of grassroots leaders since 2013, since 2014, when the hashtag becomes a social movement. And that hashtag is founded by three queer Black feminists, Alisa Garza, Opal Tometi, Patrice Kahn Cullors. And so when we think about the leaders, there are actual leaders, but we never had this one voice of the Black Lives Matter movement. We never had this one person who we all sort of equated with the BLM movement. I think what we're seeing now in the context of this, really this global social movement, we're absolutely seeing leaders in Los Angeles and in Austin, Texas, and New York City, in London, in Berlin. But these aren't necessarily leaders who are gonna become the faces of this movement. Although there have been some, Tamika Mallory, there's been some who've been really electrifying and have sort of had their social media viral moment. But I don't think that we're necessarily gonna see a replay of the 1960s where we all knew who Angela Davis, Kathleen Cleaver, Dr. King, Malcolm X were.
And Peniel, to that point, which is so critical, thank you for explaining the differences there and bringing it, the context of Ella Baker into this conversation. I wonder if the United States, being the country that it is, that it likes to have people that they recognize and people that they can connect with, is there a risk to a movement that doesn't have visible sort of brands who are leading the movement to the success of that movement? Or are these movements going to be successful with the structure that they've set up, which, as we mentioned, does not necessarily have a figurehead at the top?
Well, there is a risk because there's going to be some people who are associated with BLM, whether we're thinking about the activist DeRay McKesson or others, who've gotten criticism by people who are within the structure of the BLM for sort of taking credit for their accomplishments. So there absolutely is a risk. One of the things I've always suggested was that what BLM should do is have four or five or six representative spokespersons who would be Black women, who would be queer, who would be folks who have been sanctioned by the organization to actually be spokespersons, with the full knowledge that they are not leaders, that the organization's not top down, but it would let potential donors, potential fundraisers, people who want to support the group, actually support the group more seamlessly than when you have this kind of leaderless structure where we still see these representative figures. When we think about the George Floyd funeral, we see Reverend Al Sharpton, we see people who we can sort of connect with the civil rights movement. We don't necessarily have a person, a singular person, or a group of people like that. And I think that that would be a good strategy that still wouldn't be falling into the charismatic leadership trap, but it gives people who are outside of movements an easy way to distinguish who's connected to the BLM and who's not.
As you mentioned, Peniel, this is a movement that is now essentially international. The Black Lives Matter movement, the protests in the name of George Floyd. I'd like to bring you in here, George. We're also in a moment, and we have been, I'd say at least for the past 2 years, where there are international protests happening for civil rights and social justice in countries around the world outside of the Black Lives Matter movement. And I'm thinking about Puerto Rico last summer, protests in Sudan that have had success in reaching some of the demands that the protesters have. George, when you look at those protests, what are some of the qualities that they share in terms of their success? Are there leaders that have been generating that success, or are these, again, similar to Black Lives Matter in terms of their structure?
I think what Peniel said is absolutely right on the money. And I think one of the lessons that many have learned in the U.S. and worldwide is that in many ways, the structure of leadership that did emerge in the 1960s and 70s also became a liability, both in terms of the way that the elevation of individual leaders eclipsed the grassroots work that was really the dynamic part of organizations like SNCC, but also that leaders were able to be targeted and able to be eliminated by the powers that be. And this became a huge liability. And so I think we're struggling to develop different forms of leadership. And this is a global struggle. It's a global struggle against racism and against the legacies of colonialism. This has been going on for many years in resonance with Black Lives Matter, in resonance with struggles like the No DAPL struggle, anti-colonial struggles over indigenous sovereignty and rights. You've seen struggles in South Africa. Of course, you saw just the other day the toppling of a statue of a slave trader in Bristol, England, in front of a jubilant crowd. And so this is a global, it is a worldwide movement. And the question will always emerge of how is it possible to elevate organic leadership that emerges from movements, that remains connected to those movements, and that doesn't lose touch with those movements. And yet we have this situation in which another difficulty is the fact that the world and the political system of the United States in particular tries to impose a certain kind of leadership onto these movements. It tries to elevate certain voices, whether they're elected officials or whether they're, again, Twitter celebrities, and tries to identify these as the spokespeople for movements that are much more organic.
And George, you know, to your point about visible leaders being targets, I'm thinking about many of the leaders or the people who were demonstrating in Ferguson, for example, who were protesting against the death of Michael Brown at the hands of a white police officer there. Some of those people died or were found dead in years, subsequent years. And I think about Eric Garner's daughter, Erica Garner, who died of a heart attack in her 20s. We know communities of color, particularly Black communities, suffer extreme stress, societal stress, and otherwise. Are those other also concerns about people taking on the role of leaders to their own physical and mental health danger?
Absolutely. And I think there's no way to look at the death of Erica Garner as any kind of natural phenomenon. She was an incredibly gifted leader who heroically stood up against elected officials who were trying to water down the legacy of Eric Garner. And these things, especially the targeting of leaders in Ferguson, is something that needs to be grappled with, and movements need to be developed that can defend those organic leaders that, you know, that are embedded within those movements. They need to be able to prevent them from being targeted and from being assassinated, of course. And it needs to be said that this is an incredibly important point in this moment, where we're seeing people being unleashed on the protests. We're seeing the encouragement of right-wing vigilante racist violence against these protests. A Klan leader drove a car into a crowd, a white supremacist shot into the crowd in Detroit. And these are things that we need to be incredibly careful about as we move forward, building on the energy of the movements in the streets today.
Peniel, I'd love for you to pick up on a point that George made, really about how many of these struggles internationally are connected, whether they are affirming Black lives, whether they are challenging colonialism, in the case of Puerto Rico, for example. As we see these uprisings continue, the demands that they're asking for are also showing a lot of similarities. We've heard a lot about defunding the police. Yesterday on the show, we focused on that. How is it that the demands are in line or very similar without having these sort of figureheads at the top? Where are the demands and the ideas, for example, to restructure policing coming from in these movements?
Well, these movements are really intimately linked in a continuation of post-World War II global movements for decolonization, anti-colonialism, and indigenous self-determination. So when we think about Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and Malcolm X, they are these watershed figures in this contestation between the global North and global South since the Second World War. And that continues. And so when we think about this movement is a movement that is a version of Arab Spring, but an American and global spring. This is our Tiananmen Square with race at the center. It's a movement to defeat white supremacy, eradicate institutional racism, but it's also a movement against racial capitalism. And when we think about that term, that's just a term that means that globally, capitalism has always been based on the super exploitation of people of color, but especially black bodies because of racial slavery as the global engine to capitalism in the 17th, 18th, 19th, and 20th centuries. So what people are struggling with in the United States in the context of neoliberalism, and all that word means is just the privatization, the militarization, the commodification of public spaces for the private gain of the 1% globally, people are suffering similar deficits and similar vulnerability, whether we're talking about food hunger and food justice, child nutrition, asbestos, lead, children with asthma, the over-incarceration, the criminalization of Black and Brown people and Indigenous people globally. So they're all getting together. And even though there aren't these global leaders in the same way that we saw in the 1960s and 1970s, there are leaders nationally and globally and locally who are sharing information across social media. They're sharing information across all these different media scapes. And now people are supercharged in a way that we really haven't seen since the 1960s. And we think about this moment in 1968, May Day 1968, we had global uprisings. We had uprisings in Asia, in Latin America, in the Caribbean, in Europe, in the United States. And they were uprising for the same issues. But those movements, unfortunately, were defeated. One of the things that we tell ourselves nationally is that the civil rights movement had a beginning, middle, and an end. It starts with Rosa Parks, then MLK, and Barack Obama, he freed us all. That's not true. And what we're seeing with these protests is that 52 years later, after 1968, we now have a generational opportunity to transform and reimagine not just American democracy, but the whole state of global civil society. Who's a citizen and who's not? Why do we treat immigrants as if they're garbage and not human beings? Why do we treat LGBTQ and indigenous people as if they're less than human? And can we transform that at the local level just through a people-powered democracy? And I think we're seeing extraordinary, extraordinary transformations right before our very eyes.
One of the things that came up when I was covering the Black Lives Matter, the emergence of the Black Lives Matter movement for the New York Times, particularly after Ferguson, was from a lot of folks, particularly white journalists, the questions were focused on, well, what is this actually going to accomplish, right? What are all of these protests going to accomplish? And I think, George, I'd love your thoughts here, because I never thought that I would see as many Americans, and white Americans in particular, calling out Black Lives Matter, affirming that phrase, and also looking for policy change. I mean, can we talk a little, to me, that's a big thing that happened, right, from 2014 till today. But how do these movements, George, actually affect policy change? And is it enough for people to sustain these types of protests without a visible leader to make those policy changes happen? Or do you need somebody to make that, to go to Congress, to make those changes happen? Do you have to engage leadership, more formal leadership, for example, in Congress to get to that point?
I think we have an incredible blind spot, in particular in the United States, when it comes to how social change happens. Because we repeat over and over and over again a sort of wishful thinking that all power moves through the ballot box and that slow, gradual changes are really the way to go. And yet we're constantly shown in the streets that actually real power lay with movements in the streets making demands that cannot be denied. Every time there's a mass rebellion, whether it's Los Angeles or, you know, I've written a lot about Oscar Grant in Oakland, there's a chorus of voices that say this is not the way to make change. And yet at the same exact time that they're saying that, change is happening. At the same time that they're saying that officers are being arrested who weren't going to be arrested without these mass protests. You know, there are several compilations out there just from this week about all of the things that have been won so far, including the beginnings of defunding, including moves toward dismantling the Minneapolis Police Department and others, including the arrest and firing of different officers in Philadelphia and elsewhere. An officer in Philadelphia who was, had decades of abuse under his belt. And so these changes are happening. I think that's the first thing to recognize. The next question then is how to make them permanent, how to make them sustainable. And that does not center, I don't think, on the halls of official public power and public policy, but it definitely calls those into the equation. And here we have the difficult paradox almost that, you know, that this kind of leadership, that the moving into the electoral arena and into the political arena is both necessary and sort of poisonous to movements. It saps their energy. Anything that gets passed and changed ultimately is a watered down version of what's being demanded in the streets. And yet this is kind of the condemnation that these movements have to pass through, is that they need to push and force change into the institutional structure, even if that change will never be enough. And this is something that you see with local elected leaders, many of whom are betraying the movements today. But it's also something you see, for example, with political candidates like Bernie Sanders, who I think opened up a whole range of possibilities and inspired a lot of people, and yet ultimately did not fully reflect and would not fully reflect what's going on the ground today. But this is something that's going to be hashed out by the movements in the future. They're just in a particularly complicated situation right now because they're already locked in, for example, to Joe Biden as a presidential candidate, who is not the presidential candidate I think that many or any of those in the streets today would choose. And so what you've got actually is a movement that has a lot of avenues for change blocked. And so what we're going to see, I think, is that change is going to be concentrated on local level pressure and the keeping up of that pressure, for example, in Minneapolis, to make sure that, say, the dismantling of the police doesn't simply mean the county sheriff coming in to do all of the same dirty work that the police were doing before, but actually means the building of alternative structures that make the police unnecessary and obsolete.
Peniel, I'd like to close with you here. It's very difficult to make any predictions right now because every day feels like it's just, you know, a head spinning turn of events. But let's stick with the summer if we can. We are still in a global pandemic. We are witnessing sustained protests now for more than 2 weeks and schools out, if you will. What do you see as this movement? How do you expect this movement to develop, say, in the next couple of weeks?
Well, I think we're seeing it already. There's been calls for a major demonstration march on Washington in August 28th, which will be the 57th anniversary of the March on Washington for jobs and freedom. Ultimately, local people are organizing thousands of demonstrators in every city from Austin, Texas, to Oakland, California, to southern cities in between, the Midwest, the East Coast, and globally. So one of the things we've already seen is certain municipalities have said that they are going to redirect their allocations from criminal justice towards investments in communities of color. So we're seeing policy transformations on the ground. As well, we're seeing different corporations and different entrepreneurs and business leaders say that they want to invest in anti-racism and racial justice struggles. This is all good. It's not enough. From top to bottom, communities of color led by Black people are saying that they want to transform the way in which we think about conceptions of citizenship and democracy. And that absolutely starts at the local level, like George was saying. locally, people are going to push and pressure for the desegregation of neighborhoods, the desegregation of public schools, and also the reallocations of resources so that people can finally live with dignity and citizenship, all people. It starts with Black people, but it's for all people. So this is a struggle for universal rights through the particular prism of that Black Lives Matter movement. I think what we're going to see in the next several weeks is more protests, but also more concessions from local elected leaders, more involvement by white people who nationally, really by the millions, are beginning to get it and beginning to say they understand that there's a problem with institutional racism and white supremacy, and they want to be part of the solution instead of being part of the problem. This momentum is not going to let up. We're seeing both organizing and political mobilization, because those are two different things. The mobilization is bringing all these people together. The organizing is, what do you do in the wake of bringing those people together? And what's really heartening here and very hopeful is that we're seeing so many people come together and want concrete policy changes. They're not just coming together and criticizing or in an act of dissent. They actually want to reimagine the world. And we should be reimagining a different world as audaciously and as ambitiously as possible. There's no idea that should be thrown out, and there's nothing that is impossible, because what we're experiencing since May 25th in the aftermath of George Floyd's death is historically unprecedented for modern civil society globally. We have never, ever witnessed what we're experiencing now, and I expect us to see more of this, but I expect us to turn this into an actual social movement where we can leverage all this energy to finally achieve our country in the United States of America, but to achieve our global civil society with human rights for all people.
Peniel Joseph is a professor of public affairs and history at the University of Texas at Austin and the author of The Sword and the Shield, The Revolutionary Lives of Malcolm X and Martin Luther King Jr. And George Ciccarello Marr is a visiting scholar at the Decolonizing Humanities Project at the College of William and Mary. Peniel and George, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks
so much
for having me.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.